Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We're a short one here, so we're going to wait a few minutes to see if she's coming.
All righty.
What's the translation of El Na Rafana Allah?
Say again, Fana.
Please heal her now.
I was going to do it literally, but that's correct. The translation is, please heal her now.
And forgive me for answering first. I was thinking out my mouth. Just trying to remember if I thought it out of my mouth. I'm sorry.
There's nothing to be sorry for. Now I'll do the literal translation.
Well, you're the teacher. I'm the student here. I kind of forget that sometimes. You have to forgive me.
El is the name of God. Na, please. Rafa is heal. Na, please. La, her.
And what would him be?
Lo.
And me is Li.
Correct. But they would probably do heal him. They would. Rafa is a verb, and so they put a kaf sofit on the end of it for please heal you. Although this verse is directed to God, God, please heal her.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they would, how do they do the, there's a letter that they put on the end of verbs to identify the object of the healing in this case. But it takes, I didn't sleep well last night, so therefore my memory is,
understood. I've been trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and I finally realized this time of year I tend to get more depressed.
It's a very common experience this time of year. People go back to their family roots, and they have a memory is very dynamic in that the actual experience and the memory are never consistent. They're, one is a reflection of the other, but the reflection changes over time. So everybody, many people think that their family time, the holiday time with their family, was very happy. May have been. Over time, that perception of joy and happiness grows. So there's no way that the experience today can meet the experience of your memory. And it tends to set people on a downwards level of emotions, which we call depression, although it doesn't have to reach that low.
Well, it's also the sunlight.
It adds to it. But, you know, if you study Kabbalah, the sunlight doesn't enter into the equation as you bring your light with you. Isn't that right, Hannah?
Yeah, I was thinking in your warm blanket.
Yeah.
Yes,
me playing the cabinets, you know, in the kitchen before it gets up. That's what it is for me.
I understand. Trudy was also speaking that you have to just keep occupied and busy, you know, and focused away from those memories, because those memories are not real. They're distorted. They really are. If somebody puts you under hypnosis, if you dictated your memory normally, whatever you remember, and then somebody puts you under hypnosis and you describe it, and then you compare the two, it's two different worlds.
That's true, I would think.
It's not a question of being always true or not. It's just their levels. It's what we discussed the last couple of classes. Is the glass half full? Is the glass half empty? Or is the glass just half? And most people never get to the concept of the glass is just half. Because once you understand that there's that third option, now you can choose to be the glass is half full. But unless you recognize that it's half, you don't know the fact, you're just perceiving it, you don't have a choice. And so you fall on whichever state your chemistry, your body chemistry at that moment is. Well, I'm not sure Sheila's coming, so we will begin. Lashem Yehud Kud Shabarichu Ishkinte Bidkilu Urkimu Udkilu Udkilu Urkimu Layakta Lashem Yud He Bavavhe Beyehuda Shalim B'Shem Kol Yisrael Limud Torah Mitzvah Lasok Torah Mitzvah Vayihino Amadunai Elohinu Aleinu Maasei Yadenu Kononei Aleinu Maasei Yadenu Kononeihu. Does anybody have any questions on any of the past classes?
Not yet.
Not yet. There will come a time. Okay. There's so many ideas that we can teach, that we need to learn. But I'm trying to do it chronologically within the Bible. So we're still in the Parsha of Vayera. And the third reading starts with chapter 19. And this is after the three men / angels have visited Abraham after his circumcision. And there are three angels, but we know that angels are given one task. They're not given multiple tasks. So we have one came to heal Abraham. And that same angel came to save Lot. But what does healing have to do with saving? And if you don't make that connection, you miss the whole point. The other one comes to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. That's two of the three. And the third one comes to tell Sarah and Abraham that they're going to have this child Isaac and to name it Isaac. But it's a little strange because what we read last week and talked about briefly, the angel starts the conversation, but God finishes it. They change from the angel to God in the writing of the Torah. And so why did he send the angel?
and three angels. So which one are we talking about now?
Well, there's Raphael, which is healing. There's Gabriel, which is judgment or destruction. And Michael. Those were the three angels. And Michael is the high priest, essentially the only God spoke to Abraham at the level of El Shaddai, as we learn later in Exodus. God speaks to Moses. But to Abraham, God needs an intermediary. The intermediary is the angel. It's like he has to be introduced.
How has to be introduced? By the angel?
By the angel.
The angel doesn't need to be introduced.
No. No. But that doesn't make any sense, because God doesn't need to be introduced. But I can't really understand why the angel is there. What is his task?
To prepare Abraham.
Say again?
He had to prepare Abraham.
He had to prepare Abraham. That's very possible.
Or Abraham needed a being to introduce God. God himself be too much for Abraham.
Except God can lower himself so that he's not too much. So it's a difficult quandary. And, you know, as I once waited 13 years for an answer to a question, I'm still waiting for the answer to that question. So chapter 19, verse 1, we're starting to read in the English. And two angels came to Sodom in the evening. And Lot sat on the gate of Sodom. And Lot, seeing them, rose to meet them and bowed down with his face towards the ground. Why do I need to know that?
Well, I've always sort of heard the angels depicted as looking like men.
That's correct.
And while reading the foreigner, the stranger, it is high value. I've never heard of that being, of bowing down to the stranger who's entering,
exactly,
as being a normal practice.
Absolutely. Jacob is criticized for bowing to Esau in the Parshas Vayishlach. He bowed seven times to Esau, and he's criticized all through the various sages for bowing down. Was he bowing to Esau? Is Esau a god that he was praying to, that he was serving? One of the explanations for that is that Jacob was, by humbling himself to Esau bought into that and lessened his anger. So, but it has the ring of truth, but it also doesn't make sense, because we know how important not serving idols is. But the question I'm asking in this case, Lot has been raised and taught by Abraham to welcome strangers. But he's living in a community that, according to the Midrash, and as we'll read, he's living in a community that is horrible to strangers. The Midrash brings a story and what was the cry of Sodom that went up to God that he said, I've got to destroy this place. And it's because if you were a stranger and you walked into Sodom and you were carrying a loaf of bread, each person in Sodom would steal a few crumbs of that bread. Too small to be accused of stealing. But by the 100 people doing it, there was no bread left. And so then the stranger would complain, and they'd take him in front of the court. And the court would fine him for presenting an opportunity to the citizens of Sodom to steal. So not only did he lose the bread, but he got fined by the court. That's the kind of corruption that is described in Sodom. So it doesn't make sense why he would bow down to them unless he considered them an angel, just as Abraham did. But then, ultimately, we are not supposed to even bow down to the angels. They serve us. They serve humanity. We consider them higher because we've fallen due to the sin of Adam and Eve. But ultimately, when we are corrected, we are higher than the angels. They serve us. And he said, see now, my lords, turn aside, I pray you, to your servant's house and tarry all night. And wash your feet, and then go on your way early in the morning. And they said, no, we will spend the night in the street. And he pressed upon them greatly that they did go with him, and entered his house. And he made them a feast, and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they had gone to bed, the men of the city of Sodom surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out so that we may know them. Know, in chapter 4 of Genesis, Adam knew Eve, and she became pregnant. So the word know has sexual connotations.
Does it always?
Well, it's in the city of Sodom. The answer is yes. But yes, it almost always has sexual connotations. And Lot went outside to meet them, meaning the people of Sodom, and shut the door behind them, because he's protecting the angels. Does he need to protect the angels? One of these angels is going to destroy the city. Does he need protection? And said, I pray you, brothers, do not do this wicked thing. He's trying to talk the people of Sodom out of whatever their plans are. See now, I have two daughters who have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out to you, and you can do to them what is good in your eyes. And to these men, do nothing, for they have come under the shadow of my roof. In our current generation, Obama, Bin Laden. Osama bin Laden, excuse me. Osama bin Laden, hid in the eastern side of Afghanistan, and moved back and forth into the western side of Pakistan. But why did they hide him? There was a $10 million bounty on his head. There's no way he had the resources to pay people $10 million a day to keep him from turning him in. So why did they hide him? Why did they take care of him?
He was a stranger to him.
Because the culture, the Arab culture, which is coming from this aspect, it's describing the Arab culture in biblical times, was to protect the stranger. It was well known law to protect the stranger. Just as many times in the Bible, we're told to protect the widow and the orphan and the stranger. So that this teaching, Lot is saying, they've come into my house. I have accepted them. I have given them my protection. So you can't do this to them without going through me. He was willing to die in order to protect them for this law. But this is also the part of the teachings from Abraham. He's willing to give them his virginal daughters. I'm sure his wife wasn't going to be happy with that, right?
Let alone the daughters.
Let alone the daughters. Of course, the daughters might have wanted to get married, so you never know.
But not for the whole
city. No, but it would have been one person. It wouldn't necessarily be gang rape. And they said, stand back. And they said, this one fellow came here to sojourn, and now he wants to be a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. They kept pressing against the man Lot and moved near to break the door. So you get an impression of what the confrontation is like. They're on his doorstep. And they keep moving forward, and he's talking, but they keep pushing him back till he's almost, breaking down the door because of the pressure. But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. And they smote the men who were at the door of the house, both great and small, with blindness, so that they wearied themselves to find the door. So Lot was saved by the angels, because that's what his job was, right? To save Lot. And you can understand the relationship between healing and saving. They're both aspects of protection. And the men said to Lot, do you have anyone else here, sons-in-laws, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of this place. For we are going to destroy this place, because the outcry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. I didn't mention it before, but there was another Midrash story of that one of Lot's children had given a poor person some food, and that was against the law. And so they put her before the judge in Sodom, and they sentenced her to be covered in honey and put out for the bees to find her. And so she was just literally stung by a million stings. That's how she died. And as she was dying, that was the cry to God for the injustice of it. And that's what set off the whole idea. Is it a story? Is it true? Midrash can be either. And Lot went out to spoke to his sons-in-law, who married his daughters, and said, "Hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy this city." And his sons-in-law thought he was joking. Does that make sense? It does make sense, doesn't it? The younger generation doesn't trust the older generation. And the women have been married into the son-in-law's family. They're no longer Lot's family. He can't say to them, "Come," unless the sons-in-law, their husbands, say, "Come." And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be consumed in the iniquity of the city." And while he lingered, the men grasped his hand and in the hand of his wife and of his two daughters and led them out safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. And it came to pass when they had brought them out, that he said, "Flee for your life. Do not look back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away." And Lot said to them, "No, my lords, please. See now, your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in saving my life. But I can't flee to the mountains, lest some evil take me and I die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it is small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? And my soul will live." What is Lot afraid of?
Afraid of, apparently, of something in the mountain, since he doesn't want to go there.
Or is he wanting to live in the city? Remember, Lot and Abraham parted ways. Abraham lived in the pastures and the fields with his tents and his animals. You know, he was very wealthy in animals. Lot was just as wealthy, but he went to live in the city. What can we understand about the concept of a city? He's afraid of the mountains, it's not that he's afraid of the mountains. He wants to live in civilization. He wants to live in the comforts of the city. In our world, can you get the internet in the small country areas?
But often not.
Exactly. What does the city provide?
Communication.
Technology. But what do you give up? You give up the direct contact to the land. We all have heard stories of the children who you ask them, where does the hamburger come from? And the answer is McDonald's. Where does McDonald's get the hamburger? Where do they get the meat? It shows up automatically. They're not aware of the pipeline that fills our city, that provides all of these comforts that we have in the cities.
True story.
Yes.
When I was a young child, my great uncle brought my mother a turkey that he had raised for Thanksgiving. And giving it to her, he said, "I killed it myself. I raised it and killed it." And I was just horrified.
Right. you were horrified that you were going to be eating it, and you know, but more importantly, you were horrified that somebody killed an animal. But it's all part of this process that we don't understand. We just accept it. You know, we accept the process, we accept the gifts, we accept the results, but you know, we're not aware of it. And, you know, that was the whole idea of I think his name was Ramban Rabashkin, who was the owner of the main kosher meat processing plant in Iowa. He, as a Jew, he only processed kosher meats. So he hired people to be the butchers, to be the Schechters. And he was, you know, he was put in jail for 28 years, just recently released, and went to live in Israel.
Oh, was he released? I was wondering, I haven't heard it. I didn't hear anything.
Oh, this is, he was in jail.
I know the beginning, but
yeah.
I didn't know he was released.
Yeah, he was released like a year or two ago.
What was he in prison for?
For abusing his Hispanic employees.
Illegal.
He was using illegal labor, and then he wasn't paying them properly. And, you know, if the charges were true and he was found guilty, but that doesn't mean that it was true. But if the charges are true, it's a horrible stain and all, you know, you have kosher meat, but how could it be kosher
if you're mistreating your employees?
If you're mistreating your employees. And what came out of that is a new mark, which is not really taken off yet, but where the rabbi not only verifies that it's a kashrut, but he verifies the treatment of the employees and the working condition. So,
but 28 years is a large amount of years for that.
Yeah.
And they said
it was anti-Semitic that he was put in jail for 28 years because, you know, other people who were not Jewish, it would be 5, 4, 5, 6 years. So, and Israel constantly strive to get him released. So, Lot is supposed to move away from the city with the angels. And he said to him, very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the city you speak of. But flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it. That is why the city is called Zoar. That's a nice verse. But what does the word Zohar mean? Why is the city being called Zohar? So if you...
I know,
that's what I was waiting for. What does it mean?
I've muted myself. Bringing low.
Bringing, spell the last second word.
Low, L-O-W.
Oh, bringing low, bringing down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you look at the letters in Hebrew, Tzadi, Vav, Ayin, Resh. The last two letters, if you permutate them, you reverse them, Ayin Resh becomes Resh Ayin, which is Ra. And Ra is the Egyptian sun god, but it's also in Hebrew, it means evil. And the gematria of Tzadi, or the meaning of the word Tzadi Vav, it's Sav. It's a command. The city's name is Evil Command. So the meaning that you're getting, Hannah, makes sense from the letters. But I think the letters are more meaningful, at least to me,
right,
from that standpoint. Because Lot, who is, represents the evil inclination. The evil inclination is that part of ourselves that says, oh, you want to overeat, you want to become a glutton, you want to be with a woman that you does it's not correct for you, go ahead. And what is he, what, where does he want to go? He wants to go to this place of evil command. He wants to be in charge of evil. Now, I don't know if there's a city in Israel named Zoar or in that area named Zoar, but the Torah says...
So the word is Zoar, not Zohar.
No, it doesn't have the hay.
Yeah.
You've got to be very careful.
Yes.
Zohar, with the hay, has the meaning of brightness, light. Without the hay, you miss that. And also, Zohar is spelled Zion, Vav, He, Resh. There's no I in there. So, but you're on to something that's a spiritual law. If words sound similar, they have a connection. Understanding the connection can be difficult, like Zohar and Zohar. They sound similar, but they're very different meanings. But what they represent is two sides of the same coin. And you can get that very often in gematria, because the word Mashiach has a gematria of 358. And the word Nachash, snake, has a gematria of 358. So is the Mashiach a snake, God forbid? It's two sides of the same coin. They serve the same purpose. The Mashiach brings judgment. The snake brings judgment. Snake will never bite someone unless it's been given permission to do so. And that's what people don't understand when they run from rattlers. The only reason it's biting you is because it was given permission to bite you. Then the Lord rained down brimstone and fire on Sodom and Amorah from the land, Lord, out of heaven. The angel is saying, leave quickly because I have to wait till you get out of the way, but I'm going to bring the destruction. And earlier it said, we will bring the destruction. But here it's saying, Elohim brings the destruction. And he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all the inhabitants of the cities, and that which grew upon the ground. What does it mean, overthrow the cities? We just talked a little bit about what is wrong with the city. It keeps you away from the ground. You know where Sodom and Gomorrah were located?
Geographical.
Mm-hmm. The Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is the lowest point on earth. The water goes in, doesn't come out. What is the water? What's the source of the water? The Jordan River. But the Dead Sea is brine. It's salt brine. That's why people float on it. That's why the Israelis market cosmetic products made from the Dead Sea conditions. But the Bible is telling us that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah lowered that area of the world. And it's telling us it rained down fire and brimstone from heaven. This, in any view of where you've heard or what you've thought about, does heaven represent fire? Does heaven represent brimstone? What don't we understand? When we don't read the Bible with a questioning mind, you miss everything. As a child, you don't know enough to ask the questions. But I read it. I'm raising the question. How do we, you all, learn to question the same way? And is it meaningful for you to question like this? I think it is for me, but it may not be for you. It's everybody has that choice.
I've always, I guess, had this sort of childlike assumption that assumption that wasn't really conscious, I guess you could say, that the fire and brimstone, while they came from heaven or were sent from heaven, is we're not part of heaven.
We're not part of heaven, although that is our task, to create heaven on earth.
But I hear you asking, we don't think of fire and brimstone being in heaven, then how did it come from heaven?
No, because God can do anything. But if it came from heaven, it means it's part of heaven. The Hebrew word shamayim is heaven. That's the translation. The shin, we've learned the shin in our Hebrew class. The shin represents fire. The rest of the word is mayim, which is water. Shamayim is fire and water without separation. It has to be separated, right? You can't boil eggs without water being in a pot. You can't put fire and water directly together because it puts the fire out. The Bible is teaching us so much. Now, what am I going to do with this? How does that improve my life? How do I use that? Well, one, I put aside the fantasies of a child. Heaven has fire in it. Heaven has brimstone in it. I don't know what brimstone is. I have an image that from the books that I've read, brimstone represents warm, hot stones that get thrown. Basically, that comes from the Middle Ages, when the knights would surround the castles, and they would throw the oil, the stones that were dipped in oil and rags and fire, and that's how they burned things down and got it over the wall with the catapults. As I said, I don't know what brimstone really is, but that's my image. Now, some people say that the fire and brimstone is nuclear devices. Could be coal, could be a lot of different things. But bottom line is, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, are underneath the water of the Dead Sea. And the word overthrow is describing the lowering of the land. Why is the Dead Sea the lowest point on Earth. It's 1,300 feet below sea level. But the Mediterranean can't get to it because there's land higher than that. But what happens when you lower one part of a swing of a teeter-totter, the other side goes up? Now, this is my favorite. But his wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, what was that? What did parents keep telling them, their children, when they taught them these stories? Be good, or you're going to become a pillar of salt. But what is the meaning of, you're laughing about it.
I never heard that one. I never heard that one.
You never heard that one?
No. It was always if we didn't eat our food, think of the starving children of China. That one. But when you finish about salt, I'd like to tell you what, when I saw Sodom and I thought of salt, so I looked up those words, but go ahead with your thoughts.
Go ahead.
Right now.
Go ahead.
Before I looked up Zoar, I looked up Sodom because the thought came to me, I wonder if it's kin to sodium because of salt and because of the link between Lot's wife turning to salt. And this was the definition. Of course, this is this little English book that was published in 1909, all in English. Sodom means fettered ones. And sodomites meant set apart for unholy purposes, temple prostitutes. And Gomorrah meant bondage. So it all, you know, it all fits. But that was a funny thing to say, well, you know, first time I thought of Sodom and sodium and linking it to, you know, to ask that question and then look it up to find the answer. I think it illustrates your point of how we study and how we question, and it leads to other things, you know. So that's it.
And now I'm going to, I hadn't done Sodom in the Hebrew, but I just looked at it. It's Samach, Dalet, Mem, so feet. The word Dam, Dalet, Mem, is blood. The Samach, the essence of the Samach is support. It's supporting blood. What is blood? The nefesh, the lowest part of the soul, is in the blood, according to the Torah. Well, it's your life force because of the nefesh. You have two aspects in the blood, primarily. You have the red and the white. The white blood cells represent your immune system. If you have too few white cells, you get sick a lot. Your immune system isn't working properly. The blood cells carries oxygen, which has to go to every cell in order for it to live, life force. So it's all related there. But what the word for salt in Hebrew is malach, mem lamet chet. And what do we do with salt? When we have challah, when we're eating bread, we dip it in the salt. Why do we do that? So we studied, Hannah and I studied with my classes online. The energy of the salt, which is white, is purity. It represents positivity. It represents male energy, the sharing energy. The bread represents receiving energy, the vessel. So you dip the bread in salt to bring them together as the central column to the balance point, because you don't want to eat just bread, because it will bring you too far over to the left column, to the desire to receive, and you'll fall into the desire to receive for oneself alone. But by mixing it with the salt, the female energy with the male energy, you create the balance point, and that keeps you in balance. Go ahead.
When making hollow, using some salt, it's been a while since I've made it.
Kana, do you use salt in your recipe for challah?
Yes. You have to put it up to the corner, because if it'll interfere with your rising when it hits the yeast. So because I use the bread machine, I'll look for a little corner, you know, to put the salt in, and then I try to put the yeast over, quite a bit, you know, ways over. But it will affect
more
if you don't put
more
on rot as well.
But the yeast is what causes it to rise, as we know.
Right.
So
yeah, but so the salt does.
It's not a major component, is it?
It's not like the yeast, but it does affect your. It's not just for taste. It does also help
affect
with the rising.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the. But the question I want to ask is, we know that Hashem works mida keneged mida, measure for measure, this against that. So why was she turned into a pillar of salt for looking back? Also, why did she have to die? According to Kabbalah, no one dies without a spiritual court authorizing the death. So what occurred to me this afternoon before I came, as I was thinking about the answer, she had to die because Sarah was going to die in the next parasha. Sarah dies because her tikkun is completed. Lot is the evil inclination for Abraham. Lot's wife has to be the evil inclination for Sarah. Now, what is the idea of the evil inclination for Sarah? What does that actually represent? Sarah is the body during the tikkun process. Sarah represents the desire to receive. The evil inclination, it means it's the selfish desire to receive. What is going to happen is the start of one side of the Mashiach line of descendants. Because what happens when they get into the mountains after they go to Zohar and then they decide to go into the mountains anyway? When they get into the mountains, the two daughters of Lot sleep with him when he's drunk. And from them, two or three generations later, comes Peretz and his twin brother, which is the line that brings the Mashiach, one side of the Mashiach line. So this evil inclination has to be cleansed. And that's why she died. But why was she made into salt? That I don't yet understand, but I know that the word malach has a gematria of 78. It comes from the shoresh, meaning war, milchama. Salt is the male energy combining with the female to bring balance. But war is definitely a male energy. It's conflict. But it's on the left side. I'm just bringing these things up. I don't have answers for these questions yet, but the questions I need to ask them, and that's what Jewish history is.
So that's why she's turned into Saul. She's male, isn't she?
Yes, but she was female.
Right.
I thought I remembered the Midrash. Excuse me.
Go ahead, Kana.
Well, I thought it was from your class about the Midrash as to why the salt, why she was turned to salt, which I like the new part that you gave today with the link to Sarah and the evil inclination. But the idea is when she heard that the visitors were coming, which were really the angels, that she went about the city trying to borrow salt and let the people know that these men were coming. And so...
Okay. That explains the measure for measure. Mita keneged mita. Because she was using the subterfuge of asking to borrow salt, but really she wanted to express the gossip that she had visitors, and that so that's why they gathered around the house. So she was asking for salt, the subterfuge. So measure for measure, she's turned into salt, but.
Mm-hmm.
Just because she turned back, she was told not to turn back. But she was, you know, as a mother, she's going to be concerned about those daughters they left behind. So we can understand why she turned back, curiosity. But we don't really know her consciousness. It could be concern about her daughters left behind. It could be just straight out curiosity. She wanted to see so she could gossip some more when she got to wherever she was going. We don't know much about her, so we can't really say.
Right.
Was salt difficult to come by in biblical times?
It's not that it was difficult to come by. Salt, they're called salt licks. They're sections where they come from some animal that died millions of years ago. And in the process of their decay, they form these salt licks. Why are they called salt licks? Because the animals lick it.
Yeah. Well, I've seen cubes, I mean, like literally this big,
right,
on my relatives' farms.
Mm-hmm. So,
for the cattle.
But again, the answer to my question wouldn't be asked if we were connected to the farmland, if we were connected to the land, if we didn't live in the city and we weren't raised with city values. We would know the answer to my question, because we inherently you would know what a salt lick is, and you would understand the measure for measure. But we're so distant from that. You got to change it. And that's what the Sea of Kabbalah does. It gives us the ask questions, and eventually every question will be answered. Go ahead, Hannah.
Our first trip to Israel was in 1986, and of course later trips in 1993 and 1999 and 2009, the land had changed a lot. But we got to that area of the Dead Sea, and the bus driver stopped along the road. I mean, the rocks, the weeds, everything had salt on it. You just had to pick up a rock and, you know, you could see it, and even a branch. In fact, I picked up a piece of wood, and I used it in my classes even with the children, you know, to show. And, of course, I brought Dead Sea water back and put little drops on their hands, and we'd go outside and see the sunshine, and we could see the sea, you know, the salt pieces on our hand. And I still have little jars of water. As time goes by, you see the salt crystals on the bottom of it. But as the years went by and other trips, it wasn't so obvious on the land anymore. like it was in 1986. To see salt on rocks, to see salts on weeds, you know.
But Hannah, that is in the area of the Dead Sea, which is the Salt Sea.
Yes.
And the salt all around that area is not, what happens is you get a concentration. As the water flows in from the Jordan River, it evaporates. And over the mm-hmm. centuries, and perhaps because of the destruction, the salt is there, the water evaporates, and eventually it can rain or even not even rain, but it become a dew. It can condense out of the air. The humidity condenses out of the air, and that's where the salt is coming from, because of the concentration of the water and the salt in that area. So it's very much there. But, you know,
another interesting point is going back to the meaning of Zoar was the Jordan. The word Jordan means to go down, just like bringing low,
right.
Going down, and flows into the Dead Sea too. So you see a connection with the words, you know,
Jordan,
to the cities.
Jordan is spelled. Jordan is spelled Yud Resh Dalad Nun. And we know Dalad Nun represents Din, which is judgment, or Dan, which is the tribe. But it's essentially the tribe associated with judgment. And Yud and Resh are the letters that create the month of Elul, which is the astrological sign of Virgo. So you have to have judgment to determine the purity, which is what Virgo represents. Virgins represent purity. So you need judgment in order to determine the purity. 210, which is the gematria of Yud and Resh, the letters that create Elul, means to go down. It's a word. Radu, Resh Dalad Yud. So Radu means to go down, and its gematria is it's Resh Dalad Bav, 210. So it all ties together when we bring in all the levels of information. And to me, that's just awe-inspiring how Hashem has created the world. And we're out of time, so.
My mind kept going on a tangent about how in some places salt
mm-hmm.
is very scarce.
Yes.
In
India, the British put a tax salt when Gandhi was organizing the people in India and getting ready to overthrow the British protectorate. And so he did a march to the sea to make salt. How do you make salt? You take the sea, you put it into a container, and then you let the water evaporate, and what you have left is salt. So,
do you have time to remind us of... you talked about having a bath of salt when we're counting the Omer. Do you have time to mention that? Or are we running too late on time?
No, I can mention it. But I don't... When we count the Omer, we do that for 49 days between Passover and Shavuot. And what one of the traditions is that you take a pinch of salt, or more than a pinch, but you put it in a plastic bag, and then you hold that each night as you count. And then on Shavuot, you use that salt that has been walked, has grown step by step. you use that salt to season whatever milk products you're eating, whether the cheese or whatever. Is that what you're talking about, Hannah, or did I miss something again that I forgot?
Yeah. No, that was it. I know I buy frozen edamame beans, and they have all these little packets of salt.
Right.
So I'm able to give somebody a little bag of salt during the counting of the Omer. So if if you get those edamame beans, you can save your salt.
But it's also, again, the salt is the right column energy because it's white. It tells us
right.
It's a right column energy. It's sharing energy. And the counting of the Omer is a negative period. So you're injecting positivity into the negative period in order to balance the process. So your growth is balanced. Night after night, that's the idea behind it.
Right.
Why is it? Because first off, negative means the vessel is too small for the energy. Since the vessel is too small, it can't handle it, and so it feels overwhelmed. What happens on Passover, the light of redemption, the light of freedom, is given for free on the night of Passover, on the Seder. And then it disappears. All through those 49 days, you are growing to the level, you're building your vessel, so that when that light returns on Shavuot, which is the light of the Torah, when that light returns, your vessel is able to handle it. That's why the vessel is too small during that period. The light is there, but it's we're protected from it. So we call it that, like it disappeared, but light never disappears. But then during that period of the calendar, the energy of freedom, you have to earn it. And that's the counting of the Omer. And you want to do it in a balanced way rather than because of war. And that's something people don't understand. That's why they revolt. That's why they feel, the power, the people who are in control of the government, the power, they suppress other people. And eventually the other people explode and it becomes a revolution, it becomes a war. But the proper way, the way that the Torah tells us to behave, is build your vessel in an evolutionary process, step by step. And that's one of the things we learn from the counting of the Omer. Thank you very much for your participation, Hannah. It's really very helpful today.
Well, I appreciate the classes and also your audience there. Sometimes it's a little hard for me to hear Joe. I don't know if he's farther away or...
He is farther away and he has a soft voice, so I have to keep reminding him from time to time to raise his voice, and I'll try and do that more often.
Well, I enjoy being there.
You,
thank you.
You have a good afternoon, and we'll have the two more classes tonight. So,
okay. All right. Thank you.
Shalom Gadol. Thank you.
Shalom Gadol.